The attack caught Alara off guard, and the blade penetrated her power field and scraped her left pauldron, but did not find purchase. Alara swung her left blade under the human sword. It bit into her side just under her right arm, its arcanically empowered point and edge penetrating her breastplate and the flesh beneath. It was not a killing wound, but it stole the strength from the woman's arm, and the sword tumbled from her grip. The human yelled in anger and unexpectedly drove her forehead into Alara's face. She turned in time to prevent the direct hit to her forehead, and her power field reduced the blow to a minimal impact, but it still sent her reeling. The woman then leapt upon her, bearing her down and clawing at her face. Alara had never fought like this before, and for a brief moment she panicked. But then she remembered her training and brought a knee up sharply into the woman's wounded side, sending her rolling off. Alara staggered to her feet and found her left blade had fallen from her grasp. She still had the right one, and she moved swiftly to cut the human's throat, opening a wide red gash that gushed shockingly red blood. The woman's eyes bulged, and she gasped as if startled. Again, Alara felt the power through the blade, the sense of life's energy flowing through it and into her. These were the weapons of the third chamber, blessed of Lilas. She felt dizzy and her stomach remained unsettled, but she was becoming accustomed to it. Her adrenaline was pumping, and she knew she had little time. The gunshot. The others would be coming. She recovered her other blade and went to the Myrmidon where it lay on the grass. She could sense its cortex more strongly now, waiting and ready. Its motivation systems were powered down, or it would already have stood to fight alongside her. She knelt beside it and placed a hand on its armored surface, closing her eyes. She calmed her breathing and her mind and reached out for it, as she had been taught. Its mind awaited her behind a swirling grid of barriers like interlocking gears. She focused on sending it the images, sounds, and words she had been drilled to remember. The gears began to separate. She sensed something coming, an imminent threat, and it distracted her. She could feel them approaching up the hill, rushing as quickly as they could. A flash of warning told her the gun mage had his weapon out. She could feel him drawing his energy. She moved just a little too late, leaping over the Myrmidon to get to the other side where its bulk would partially shield her. The shot rang out and something searing struck her. Her power field was at full strength and absorbed much of the bullet's energy, but the powerful magic-enhanced shot pierced through, penetrating her armor at her left side below her ribs. Pain blossomed but was quickly drowned in a surge of adrenaline. She landed on the far side of the Myrmidon and hunkered down as another shot struck its armored hull. She touched her side, and her hand came up with blood. She hoped it was not a serious wound. Again she reached out mentally to the Myrmidon, even as she heard shouting and sensed others circling to flank her. The gun mage had taken cover behind his wagon and was waiting for the rest to drive her into the open so he could fire again. Alara put this from her mind as she focused on the interlocking gears she sensed in her mind, sending the sequence of images, words, and impressions. The gears parted and her mind joined with the Aspis's cortex. She sensed it was fully empowered, having been drawing on the inherent arcane energies of its environment as it rested idly. There was a high-pitched whining, and then a vibrating thrum as its internal systems engaged, drawing on full reservoirs of arcane power. Its motors activated swiftly, and suddenly she was able to see through its eyes and feel its readiness for battle as it pushed itself to its feet. Alara felt the Myrmidon's strength and power as if it were her own. There was another humming sound, and she felt an electric tension in the air as its field generator kicked in and its power field activated. A shimmering barrier formed around the Myrmidon that was similar in many respects to the power field generated by her Warcaster armor. The Aspis was a machine she had never controlled before, an exotic, light Myrmidon intended for bodyguard duty. Unlike the griffin she had become accustomed to in training, it had no large shield, no long halberd. Its arms did not end in hands at all, but rather a pair of complex orbs, each shimmering with blue energy. These devices could strike with tremendous impact, enough to drive back even heavier machines. One of the humans shouted, "Look out! The warjack is up! Another one cursed and invoked the name of his human god. Alara sensed them around her, closing in. They were scared of the Myrmidon, but still had the advantage of numbers, and the gunmage knew she had been hit. Despite it all, Alara felt a surge of excitement. Now, here amid the life and death struggle of actual battle, she felt alive and in her proper place. Her mind was joined with the Myrmidon, and she watched through both its eyes and hers, scanning those who approached. She had never felt so smoothly integrated with a Myrmidon. It truly felt like an extension of herself. To her left was a man with a long knife in each hand, circling around the overturned wagon. On the other side were two others, one with a steel-tipped spear and one with a long, wide-bladed sword. The gun mage and a woman who also had a pistol were at the wagon. Alara heard the woman sob on finding the driver's corpse. The horses at the front of the wagon were snorting and unsettled by the smell of blood, yet unwilling as yet to bolt. Alara raised a hand and gathered her arcane power, finding the runes now coming quickly to her mind. Practice in the days she had traveled with Kalissa was paying off. A white bolt of energy flew from her hand and struck the swordsman in the chest, creating a smoking blackened ring that blazed through his torso and out the other side. He screamed and fell, and Alara felt some of his living essence flow back through her and into her Myrmidon. She burst into action, springing away from the shelter of the Myrmidon to intercept the man with the daggers. Two pistol shots rang out. The woman's normal bullet barely missed her to splinter the wood of the downed wagon. The gun mage's empowered shot was truer, but it was for this the Aspis was designed. Its fully charged power field existed as a haze that bent the light around it. Faster than the blink of an eye, a portion of this field extended to intercept the bullet intended for Alara, absorbing its energy. The glowing bullet lost its luster and fell inert to the grass while the Myrmidon's field banked and diminished. In the next moment, Alara was on the knife fighter, whose eyes widened at the ferocity of her attack. He was skilled and nimble and managed to evade and parry her first strikes, but she did not relent, lunging to open a wide gash in his upper thigh. He stumbled, and her other blade cut deep into his shoulder, sending him falling back. She followed and slashed across his midsection. He moaned and writhed as blood gushed from the wound. Her blades collected his dying energy, which flowed through her and into her aspis already closing on the spearman. She was inside the machine's mind, towering over the terrified man, 9 feet tall and 2 tons of armored metal. She backhanded him with one of its repulsor fists, which erupted in blue sparks as it impacted his chest. His ribcage shattered as he was hurled end over end to topple against the wagon, multiple internal organs crushed. Alara moved close to the aspis again so she could rely on its protective field and gathered her arcane power, intending to eliminate the gunmage at last. As she turned, she saw him pulling his last compatriot up behind him on a horse he had cut free. He turned and fired as they began to gallop away, scowling as the Myrmidon's power field once more absorbed the shot. The field banked very low, temporarily depleted, but she knew it would soon recover. Without hesitation, she ran forward and raised her hand, sending a bolt of energy at the gunmage, but her spell missed by several feet and disappeared into the field. The aspis moved forward to join her, but neither had any chance of outrunning the horse. Alara felt deep frustration at the sight of the fleeing gunmage, particularly when he fired his pistol into the air, sending an orange-red flare into the darkening sky that would be clearly visible to anyone watching at the house for their return. She looked around at the blood-drenched battlefield, still shocked and sickened at the corpses, but neither this nor her own blood seeping from the gunshot wound in her side was the reason for the sinking feeling in her stomach. It was the certainty of disaster. She hurried off the main road, although she knew her spilled blood and the heavy steps of the Myrmidon would make her trail easy to follow, and made for the cover of the nearest trees. Her mission was a failure. Her mouth felt dry and she swallowed. She had proven a capable killer and perhaps had made Lilas proud, but then she had let the gun mage escape. There was little chance of assaulting the farmhouse now. She shook her head against rising despair and considered her options. She felt angry both at herself and at those she had failed to kill. Nothing had gone as expected. Was it her duty to attack the farmhouse now? They would be ready, hunkered down, likely with additional firearms. The Aspis could stop only one shot at a time. There was a part of her that insisted she should make the attempt regardless. No worthy assassin of the third chamber would accept such a failure. Better to get inside that house and kill the gun mage, even if it meant her life. She felt the strong urge to obey this imperative. If she were to fail this trial, at least she could strike down one foe of the retribution. The Aspis multiplied her power considerably, though she had no doubt those remaining at the house could overwhelm the two of them. There was also the fact that she was wounded. She could feel herself weakening. All it would take was one stumbling step, one moment of disorientation, and she would be killed. Still, there was no shame in such a death. Better than facing failure in the eyes of Kalissa, or anticipating the look of disappointment in the face of Kaldikan Sinvis. Tempting as this was, she knew it was wrong. The Myrmidon she had recovered could not fall to the humans. Its return was more important than the immediate death of one gun mage, a man who could be hunted down later. Whatever paper she had been sent to recover could not measure against the value of an Aspis and the knowledge the humans could glean from it. More than this, she recalled Myolir's bitter words, "You are more valuable to the retribution than everyone else training in this fortress." She found this difficult to believe, given her poor performance, but she knew it to be true nonetheless. Flawed though she was, the retribution needed warcasters. It would be selfish to throw her life away in some futile gesture. She had to accept her failure and return. Clearly, she was not ready to be a tyro. In time, she could redress her mistakes. Reluctantly, she turned away from the townhouse and made her way toward the thick line of trees to the east. She winced at the pain in her side and leaned against the silently implacable Myrmidon as she walked. She had not traveled even half the distance before she found Kalissa waiting for her, alone. The warcaster's expression was unreadable, but then she came forward and showed concern at the blood on Alara's side. "Here, let me deal with that," she said as she pulled a roll of bandage material from one of her pouches. She helped Alara remove some of her armor and bound the wound while they sat in silence. "I'm sorry about my performance," Alara said at last, miserable, having been awaiting a rebuke. "There, that should hold. Let's get your armor back on," Kalissa said, as if Alara had not spoken. "It'll cause you pain until you can rest properly, but the bleeding should be stopped. You need to be careful not to exert yourself or make any sudden motions. Now, come with me." They did not enter the woods, as Alara expected, but walked west again, back toward the area she had left. Despite the questions arising in her mind, Alara remained silent. She could not find the right words. Kalissa was the first to speak. "The Crucible," she began, then paused. "It is a strange and difficult thing. I have never heard anyone describe one that was easy, and no two are ever the same. I did not enjoy subjecting you to this, just as I did not enjoy my own crucible when I was put through it by Gareth." She spoke of the Blade of Retribution, a man with a legendary reputation and one of the most fearsome and ruthless of the sect's warcasters. They stepped to the edge of the trees, and Alara realized they could see the farmhouse from here. Dusk had fallen, leaving the house and the barn as silhouettes against a darkening sky. Again, Alara drew her goggles over her eyes to see better. Smoke was pouring from the back of the farmhouse. She saw furtive figures moving against that backdrop. There was an eruption of distant gunshots and shouting. She looked sharply at Kalissa, but the senior warcaster's attention remained locked ahead, staring through her own goggles. After a moment, Kalissa said,
No mission is ever undertaken alone in the Retribution. Your brothers and your sisters always fight alongside you, prepare the way for you, or help you find your way home. A strike force is both a team and a family. Where one member fails to kill a vital target, another will finish the job. This brings no shame. It is how the work must be done. Our cause is larger than any of us. There is no one else who will see it done.
Fires were spreading in both the townhouse and the barn, but the sound of gunfire had ended. More shadows could be seen racing away from the buildings, heading in their direction. Soon Alara could see the shapes of the members of Kalissa's strike force. They inclined their heads to both her and Alara. One of the first to return tossed a satchel to Kalissa, which she caught in one hand. Alara felt her cheeks burning as she realized it was her objective. She was distracted from these thoughts by the sight of three mage hunters at the rear, advancing closely together. She saw Gyrus between two others, being helped along as they supported her weight. Alara sucked in a breath and felt the pang of fear, but was reassured when Gyrus smiled at her as she neared.
"A bullet through the leg," she said. "But I got him. The gun mage."
Her eyes were bright with pride. Her first kill as a mage hunter assassin. Alara felt no envy for her friend, only gladness. One small wrong in the world corrected. The others took Gyrus away, promising to see to her injury.
"We should go," Kalissa said. "But first, I should tell you. You did not fail."
The words were such a shock that Alara could only blink at her stupidly.
"What? But my objective? The Crucible is not about accomplishing an objective. It is a trial to see how you handle complications and setbacks. It is designed to test your judgment as much as your ability. You must be able to put the needs of the Retribution above other considerations. Completing a mission at all costs will not always serve our cause. Granted, it would have been superlative had you managed to recover the satchel as well as the Myrmidon and killed the gunmage, but I did not expect that. Had you handled things differently, perhaps Gyrus would not have been injured cleaning up after you. There is always a cost. Your choices have an impact on your brothers and sisters. You have learned that lesson. Still, you did well. Recovering the Myrmidon and recognizing your limits proves your judgment. You have passed the Crucible and are now a full Tyro."
Alara accepted these words and felt amazed, but found it a bitter lesson. She considered Gyrus and hoped she would be all right. She felt no different from a moment before, and was aware of how much she still had to learn, as well as how little time she would have. The Retribution stirred, and would soon march to war. She knew every day there might be circumstances similar to what she had faced in her Crucible, more impossible choices, more occasions where her anger might overwhelm her. But she also felt committed, now more than ever. As she walked alongside Kalissa, away from the fires, and saw the other mage hunters moving as shadows ahead of her, she felt a deep kinship with them for the first time. She was no longer an outsider, no longer Nymeth. She prayed to Lylas and to Syra, asking for the strength and courage to see both her parents and their gods avenged.
Gypsy's Luck. Written by Darla Kinnerud and read by Brian Reed.
Merowyn, Cadoran Occupied Lael, Early Spring, 607 AR.
"Morrow, but this city is a hell of a rat hole."
Gaston Cross looked out over the dirty marketplace of Lower Merowyn from where he leaned against the corner of a building. The day was slightly less damp and cold than recent days, and the street was filled with hawkers, shoppers, and the occasional knot of fleecers, orphans and runaways who lived on the streets in groups and survived by begging and thieving. He'd been a fleecer too, but at 16, he knew better. It was much safer to work alone. The city had once been a thriving hub of trade among the Iron Kingdoms, or so he'd been told. but that had all been before his time. The weasel-faced nobles, the ones who'd run the country since the death of the last king over a decade ago, had thrown it all away for money, food, and pleasure, while everyone else scraped to get by. There was little enough to scrape now, under the heel of the Kidorans, with their foul vodka-laced breath and their nasty boiled meats and their coarse, brutish ways. Disgust turned Gaston's stomach as he surveyed the marketplace from behind the curtain of dark hair that fell over his face. To the left, just before the stand where Andrea guarded her spiced meat pies, walked the middle-aged man, well-dressed but with more gut than shoulder, lecturing a boy with glazed eyes. Gaston took note of the purse-sized bulge in the man's coat. Across the muddy street, thin-faced old Neil looked anxiously out from his pitiful farm stand, which showed only winter cabbages and some ugly, misshapen roots. Nearer, in front of the woolery, a flushed young servant girl balanced a pile of parcels. Her huge eyes tried to look everywhere at once, drinking in the bustle of the crowd as she waited on her mistress. He glanced to the end of the street, and his gaze fell on the Cadoran soldier facing the market. The man's square, ugly face was unreadable behind a black mass of beard, but his eyes swept suspiciously over the crowd as though looking for any excuse to exert his power, and the axe he wore glinted dangerously. Gaston quickly looked away, careful to keep his hands from touching the pair of long dueling knives he wore at his belt. He didn't recognize the soldier, but the man obviously took his job more seriously than some others.
"I'd better move on for now," Gaston thought.
He'd barely taken a step when shouts broke out over the general noise of the marketplace. He turned to look. Old Neil had a hold of someone's coat sleeve, and the small, red-faced man whose arm was in that sleeve was sputtering and shouting as he tried to twist out of the farmer's grip. A wiry woman with a basket in one hand was yelling at both of them and pointing toward the edge of the farm stand, but both men ignored her. Gaston saw a red-haired woman clutching a stack of papers duck around the side. A sharp, deep voice carried over the tumult, "Order! Order! What's the trouble?" The Cadoran guard strode toward the farm stand, his hand on the haft of his axe. Wasting no time, Gaston dove into the crowd, walking fast. Most of the shoppers were turned toward the commotion, watching the scene unfold. As he passed the woolery, Gaston let one hand brush the top parcel from the servant girl's stack without slowing. She paid no attention. He probably could have stopped to go through the whole stack if he'd wanted. He weaved around gawkers and shoppers, then turned to head back up the street, as if to circle around the ruckus. He headed toward the father and son he'd been watching. Just as he neared them, he tripped on a stone in the street and pitched forward with a cry. The parcel flew out of his hands, and he stumbled directly into the broad-bellied man and his son. Gaston and the boy almost hit the ground, but the sturdy gentleman held them both up at the last second.
"Ho there! You'll knock the wind out of your lungs. Hubert, are you all right?"
the man said as he let go of the hood on Gaston's shirt and looked at his son, who nodded with a dazed expression. Gaston put on a concerned look.
"Sorry, I'm very sorry, really. I should watch my step. I was distracted."
He waved toward the farm stand and the Cadoran guard. Even the wealthier residents of Merrowind stepped carefully around the soldiers, who would often arrest someone as soon as look at them. The man's expression darkened.
"Yes, understandable. A person can't walk 20 paces without a soldier's eye on him, and they control everything in and out of the city as well. It's bad for business."
Gaston nodded and began looking around on the ground. The man spotted the parcel where it had been flung, then he nudged his son and pointed at it with his chin. The boy scrambled for the package and handed it to Gaston, who wiped off a bit of mud with one hand.
"Ah, thank you. I'm sorry for disturbing you."
He straightened and bowed slightly.
"Good day," he said.
"Yes, well, no harm done. Good day,"
said the gentleman, returning the bow. Gaston continued up the street away from the market, slipping a meat pie under his coat as he passed Andrea's stand. She stood several steps away, where she'd moved for a better look at the commotion across the street. The din had faded, but the Cadoran was still barking at those involved. No one paid Gaston any special attention when he disappeared into a side street. Almost no one. A deeply hooded figure near the woolery watched Gaston slip away, just as she had watched him work his trade. She'd used the distraction of the guard to make her way through the market unnoticed, but when she saw the young man whisk away that first parcel, she paused to see what he'd do next. It had been worth the delay. His timing was perfect, his footwork quick, and his fingers light. From his avenue of escape, she surmised he knew the area intimately. And there was something else about him. She'd have to look into this enterprising young man. He could be an excellent asset to the cause if properly handled. She turned and continued to the tinker's shop at the other end of the market street. If the young thief worked this area, Cloutier would know who he was. She would bring it up after their other business. Gaston took the last bite of the meat pie and licked the juices off his fingers with a sigh. Maybe once summer came, the pies would be bigger again. The winter had been hard on everyone, but it was a sad thing when the pastries had to suffer. He ducked into another alley and made his way to the back of Jules's old shop. The place had been closed up since the shoemaker had taken sick, but Gaston still found himself coming by regularly. This part of town, well behind the beauty walls that kept Merowyn's more desperate citizens from the sight of its wealthier ones, had hardly ever been what he'd call busy, but in the last year it had grown emptier, all the better to avoid curious eyes. Gaston flipped over an empty crate to use as a table, then pulled another over and sat down to look through the morning's wages. The paper-wrapped parcel he set aside for the moment. He was more interested in the prize from the stout gentleman and his son. "Come on, gorgeous," he thought, as he loosened the cord on the silk purse and emptied it onto the crate. His heart leapt at the welcome clink of coins, but there was only a small handful, which he scooped back into the purse. Besides that were three rough-edged red stones the size of a fingertip. He picked them up in turn, examining them closely. They didn't look like much, but he knew better than to judge the worth of a thing by its exterior. The smallest one had a visible vein across the broadest part, but there were many tricks a good jeweler could do to work around such flaws, so perhaps the stone would still bring some gold. He pushed them aside and reached for the parcel. He let his fingers rest on the brown paper, picturing what could be inside. A fine scarf? Leather gloves with a bit of embroidery? His mother had always made him guess what his presents were, even when she knew he'd seen her knitting the mittens or sketching the picture. The game had brought a sliver of sunlight to their otherwise harsh life, and he'd kept it up over the years. A noise from down the alley brought him to his feet in an instant, but it turned out to be just a scavenging mongrel. The two stared at each other for a second, and then the hound went back to its search. Gaston tore open the parcel and found lengths of fine green cloth and white lace. A smaller packet held matching thread, cord, and ribbon. He pursed his lips, considering. He'd been hoping for something more valuable, but this would do. And he knew just the person to see next.
"Come to order a gown for your sweetheart, Gaston?"
Tante di Viscani said, and chuckled as she snipped a thread of the dark grey cloak she was mending. Her nephew, Fitch, a boy of 14 who was sweeping the small shop, looked up eagerly.
"Actually, I brought the gown to you," Gaston said.
He pulled the bundle of cloth from his bag and spread it out on the work table.
"The color of summer grass, and look how it shines against the lace like,
a field with frolicking lambs." The middle-aged woman laughed.
"And what lady wouldn't want to remind her lover of bleeding sheep? My boy, you're not made for fancy talk. I don't suppose I want to know where that came from."
She sighed at Gaston's shrug, but set the cloak aside and came over. Fitch sidled up alongside her as she fingered the green cloth appreciatively.
What a pleasure it would be to make a dress of this. But my customers can't afford such luxury. I'll have to cut it into parcels. I can give you 20 keeps.
Only silver. And keeps at that? You know our old coin doesn't buy what it used to.
Gaston's voice was tinged with anger.
Madame di Viscani gave him a sharp look.
That's the truth, and there's not one of us in Merewyn that doesn't know it. But keeps is what I have.
When he didn't reply, she added,
It's a risk at any price. I can't have the city guard around, even if Captain Enzo is a good man. It's bad for business.
Fine, he said. I'll take the 20 keeps.
She nodded.
I have something else, he added. A few stones. Not as convenient to carry as coins, but you must handle some different currencies. Exchanging them for me would make up for this poor deal.
Stones? I don't handle that sort of payment unless I have to. Carrying them isn't the only inconvenience.
Just take a look, Gaston said, taking them from the purse and holding them out. Please?
Despite her objections, the seamstress held out a hand, and he passed them to her. Fitch craned his neck to get a look.
You lucky bastard, he breathed.
Tante examined them for a moment, but then shook her head.
They might be worth something, but not for me. I can't take them.
She set them on the table, then retrieved her money box and shears. Gaston ran through names in his mind. Which of his contacts could he trust enough to ask next? He didn't like to trade in currencies that got attention. Seeing Fitch ogling the stones, he picked out the smallest and tossed it to him.
Maybe it'll bring you luck, Gaston said, though it hasn't brought me any so far.
Fitch grinned as his aunt raised her eyebrows at him.
Gaston watched as Tante counted keeps into his hand. Then she cut a short length of the lace, which she folded and handed to him.
Never know when you're going to meet someone special, she said.
Gaston snorted but took the lace. I like being alone, he said.
For now, maybe, answered Madame di Viscani. But the world is harsh, my boy, and people need each other.
Not me, said Gaston as he headed for the door. Fitch followed him into the street. Gaston glared at the younger boy and braced himself for the inevitable suggestion that Fitch should come along with him instead of helping his aunt. The boy had gotten it into his head that the two of them would make a good team. Fitch said abruptly,
Gaston, aren't you tired of working the whole city for a few coins?
No, it's my life's dream, Gaston said. The younger boy glanced around nervously and pulled Gaston aside, then leaned in and said in a low tone,
What would you say if I told you I knew of a much better target?
Gaston raised an eyebrow, and Fitch continued,
I know where there's a lot of money changing hands in secret. No soldiers or officials, just a private thing. We could get in easy, take a night's earnings, with no trouble.
Gaston couldn't hide his surprise. No trouble at all, eh?
What do you know about that?
Fitch drew himself up to speak, but Gaston cut him off. Never mind. Tell me about this private thing.
It's an illegal gambling hall, Fitch said. Bertrand Delacroix runs it at his shop after hours. It's been going on for a few weeks, drawing people from all over town to throw money at each other.
Gaston watched Fitch closely. The kid was a troublemaker, but this was the first he'd heard about a gambling operation. Then it hit him. Oh, no. How did you hear about this place? Fitch looked at his feet, his shoulders hunched.
I've been there. A few times. What?
Gaston glanced around and lowered his voice again. Fitch colored and then went white. Gaston ran a hand through his hair and took a breath.
Out with it. What happened? I was chumming up to these dandies at the tavern, and they got pretty far into their cups. Then one decided they could do with a change of scene and brought up the gambling hall. I invited myself along.
At Gaston's expression, he added,
I wasn't going to play, but the one dandy gave me a few crowns, and the other put them on a number, and I won, and they kept
taking the winnings and placing bets, and I kept winning.
Until I stopped winning, Fitch said in a miserable tone.
But I had so much money, Gaston, right there in my hands, I just had to get it back.
But you didn't.
No.
And you kept playing.
Yes.
Gaston steeled himself to ask the question that would reveal how much trouble the kid was in. Fitch, you have to tell me.
Did you borrow money?
Fitch nodded.
A lot of money?
The boy nodded again, and Gaston cursed. Everyone in their neighborhood knew better than to borrow money. The poor never win that game, thought Gaston. Never. Fitch looked up at Gaston, the bravado gone from his eyes, and Gaston saw the 7-year-old he'd known back when Tante had taken him in. Even then, the boy was always a step behind him, more often than not breaking the small mechanical items Gaston had scrounged and fixed up to sell. Fitch said,
I have to pay them back in another week, or they'll come after me. They'll burn the shop, Gaston.
His voice broke, and he stood shaking.
Pigs and piss, this was serious.
Okay, I get it. Gaston put a hand on Fitch's shoulder. We'll take a look at this place and see. He put on a stern expression at the relief in the boy's eyes. But if I say it's not doable, that's it. We'll figure something else out, but you'll stay away from that place. Fitch nodded. What now? Gaston thought. Despite Fitch's overblown ideas, he'd never done anything like this. One thing was certain. He wasn't going to let the kid anywhere near a big job if he could help it. And this one sounded like a rat's nest. Gaston would do his own scouting, and if the situation seemed decent, he'd take the place himself. He adopted a brisk tone. We can go in 4 days. Can you wait that long? Fitch nodded again and started to speak, but Gaston cut him off.
Not a word of this to anyone, he said. If you go blowing about it to impress your friends or some girl, I'm done. If you go near the place yourself, I'm done. And I swear, Fitch, if you do anything this stupid again, I'll take it out of your idiot hide myself, got it?
Fitch nodded again.
I won't, I swear. Morrow, help me, I won't.
Gaston shifted his weight from one foot to the other to keep the blood moving in his legs. He'd been hidden in this spot for hours, watching, and the cold had long ago worked its way through his clothes. From his vantage point on the balcony, he could see the entire street, but he kept his focus on the building directly across from him, a mid-sized, two-story building in decent repair, especially compared to the rest of the neighborhood. For 2 nights he'd watched as well-dressed men, working folk, and the occasional couple had made their way to the building and been allowed entrance. There must be some sort of password, but whoever guarded the door didn't seem to be too strict about it, based on the number of people well into their cups who made it in. He could attach himself to one of those groups easily enough. He also knew every window and door in the building, and he'd figured out the gambling itself happened on the second floor. He checked his pocket watch again. He'd pieced it together from bits he'd scrounged or traded for, and though he was proud he'd been able to get it working at all, he knew it tended to run slow. To make up for this, every day before coming here he'd adjusted it according to the town bells. As on both of the previous nights, one of the guards had left just after 1 a.m. The other would stay until closing at 3 and then would accompany the boss home. There had been no sign of other guards, and like Fitch had said, there had been no sign of soldiers or the city guard. Gaston was grateful for that. Captain Enzo was never hard on petty thievery, but this was a different kind of nut altogether. Gaston waited half an hour after the guard had turned off the street, just in case the man returned for a forgotten glove or scarf. He was just preparing himself to move when the door to the building opened and a tall, broad-chested man left the building, carrying a heavy-looking travel bag with several outside pouches.
"Sweet Morrow," Gaston thought. "Must have been a lucky night."
The gambler paused to adjust his coat and hat, and Gaston's mind raced through possible scenarios. This was too good to pass up. The man entered the street, and Gaston started to climb over the railing to make his way down. He heard footsteps from down the street and froze. He could see three men approaching. The one in the lead was slightly built, in a heavy, fitted coat and tall boots. The other two held back on either side of him, hulking shapes in shorter coats and heavier boots. Definitely trouble. All three were focused on the gambler, and Gaston eased himself back into his hiding spot to watch. The man in the center called out to the gambler, who replied. Gaston couldn't make out the words, but the gambler's tone made it clear these two were not friends. A movement in the shadows caught Gaston's eye, and he could make out two more large figures stealing toward the gambler from behind. All five of the approaching men produced weapons as they continued to move toward the gambler, surrounding him. The slender man said something else with a nasty laugh, and the gambler looked around at the surrounding men. In a flash, the gambler dropped his bag on the street with a thunk and drew an imposing gun of his own, a huge quad iron. The approaching men stopped in their tracks. Gaston stared at the gun, astounded at the size of the thing, but the large man aimed it easily. The air grew thick with tension, and Gaston's breathing echoed in his own ears. The two men on the street exchanged another few words, but the thug stayed back, waiting for orders or for the gambler to make a move. Something on the midsection of the gun began to glow bright blue. The two men's voices rose in anger, and then, suddenly, all five of the strangers charged the gambler. He and the leader kept their eyes on each other and fired their weapons. Instead of two gunshots, Gaston heard several, enough to leave his ears ringing. A sickly green light gathered on the men facing the gambler even as their bodies slumped to the ground. Recoiling from the foulness of that light, Gaston threw himself down onto the balcony, his arms covering his head. A cold, keening wind washed over him, and he felt an icy prickle down his spine. After a moment, he realized the whine in his ears was only an echo, and he crawled to the edge of the balcony and peered down onto the street. The scene was strangely similar to what he had seen just a moment before, yet decidedly different. Where each man had stood, now lay a body, unmoving. "All dead," Gaston thought with both relief and wonder. Next to the gambler sat his untouched bag. Gaston scrambled to his feet and climbed down from the balcony, glancing up at the gambling hall and in both directions of the street before moving from the shadows. Surely someone had heard and would come to investigate. He didn't have much time. He went straight for the gambler's bag but froze when his eyes fell on the faces of the attackers. Even for dead men, they didn't look good. Where there had been hulking forms and threatening expressions, now he saw twisted, withered shapes with gray faces frozen in agony. The boss and three of the thugs had the same unnatural, shriveled look. It was almost a relief to see the corpse of the fourth thug staring blankly into space as it stained the street with blood. He turned and looked down at the gambler. This man he'd been about to face alone had taken out an entire gang of thugs in seconds. His eyes went to the gun, the quad iron that could fire so many perfect shots so quickly. It was gorgeous, and unlike anything he'd ever seen. He set down the bag and picked up the gun to examine it. He had to use both hands. It was so heavy. Turning it over to get a look at the mechanica, he noticed an intricate silver inlay on the weapon's exotic wood housing, continuing onto the barrel. A sudden groan spilled from the gambler, and Gaston realized the man wasn't dead. His trance broken, Gaston grabbed the bag again, then paused. He pulled the stolen silk purse from his pocket and dropped it on the big man's chest. The few coins in it clinked as it landed. for your trouble, he said, smirking. He glanced around again, then took off into the alley with both the gun and the bag.
We were supposed to go together. You said you'd take me,
Fitch said, his anger and disappointment clear. Even in the empty shop, he kept his voice low. Gaston shook his head and pushed the heavy purse across the table to the kid. No, I didn't. And it's a good thing, because that place was dangerous. Last thing Tante needs is you in some Kidoran jail where not even Captain Enzo can help you, with those men still hot to get their money one way or another.
I was going to take care of that. I had it all worked out. I didn't need you to do everything for me. I'm not a kid, Gaston.
Fitch took a breath, wringing his hands. Just take the money and be done with it, Gaston said firmly. I kept some for my trouble, of course, but there's enough to get you out of the kettle you're in and have some to spare. Pay the loan, forget about gambling, and keep yourself out of the way for a while. Everything should be all right. He reached for the cup of flat ale at Fitch's elbow, and the boy's eyes grew wide.
What's that?
Fitch cried, staring at the large quad iron under Gaston's coat. Gaston quickly adjusted his coat to hide the gun and scowled at Fitch.
Just something I picked up recently. Forget about it. I don't even know if I'm going to keep it.
Fitch looked shocked.
Why wouldn't you keep it? The thing is amazing. Can I hold it?
No, Gaston said, startling Fitch with his vehemence. He swallowed and took another tack.
Yeah, it's big, so it's not especially easy to hide, obviously. If one of those Kadoran brutes spots it and asks me for papers, there's no way I'll avoid arrest. It's heavy, too, and it's throwing off my balance. This kind of gun demands attention, and that is one thing I can do without. It just might be more dangerous than it's worth.
So what are you going to do with it?
Sell it, most likely.
Are you crazy? Even if you could find someone to take it, what you'd get is nothing compared to its real value. When are you ever going to have a gun this impressive again? With a weapon like this, people have to take you seriously. That would get you a lot more than a handful of coins.
Seeing the look on Gaston's face, Fitch continued,
Come on, Gaston. Haven't you ever thought about a job that would set you up for life? Not even for a minute? You could get the hell out of this dung heap of a town. Make a real life.
Set me up for life or end it, Gaston said. It's a lot easier to get killed than it is to get rich. He paused, considering. He'd refused to tell Fitch any of the details of that night, other than that he hadn't actually entered the gambling hall, and he hadn't intended to tell him more. Idiot's going to get himself killed chasing after gold, he thought. He had to tell him something.
You want to know where I got the gun?
Fitch nodded eagerly. I took it off a man I thought was dead, after he killed a whole gang of other men I know were dead. Thinking of the gray, wasted corpses he'd seen, Gaston suppressed a shiver. I don't know what the fight was about, and I don't want to know. I thought the gun might be worth something, so I took it. I tell you, though, Fitch, I don't want to bleed my life out into the street just to settle some argument. Carrying a gun marks you. The kid shook his head in disbelief, but he didn't keep trying to convince Gaston that glory and riches awaited him. Instead, he took the purse from the table, muttered something like thanks, and disappeared into the apartments behind the shop. Gaston looked around. He'd been bringing Tante di Fiscani goods since he was 9, and she'd always treated him fair. She was a resourceful woman, immovable at times. That might help with the local troublemakers, but it wouldn't serve her well against the kind of men Fitch had gotten mixed up with.
Haven't you ever thought about a really big job, one that would set you up for life?
Of course he had. Every time he had to work the feeling back into his frozen fingers or fill his belly with river water so it would stop rumbling, he thought about it. He'd spent countless hours imagining takedowns and dreaming of what he'd do next. Not travel. He couldn't bear to leave Merriwin and his mother's grave, but there were plenty of other options. He could open a locksmith's or a tinker's shop where he'd be able to mess around with gears and parts to his heart's content. For as long as he could remember, he'd only needed to examine mechanical things, hold them in his hands, in order to figure out how they were put together. Sometimes, he could even see the way something should have been built in the first place. Real life wasn't nearly so straightforward. Feeling restless, Gaston left the Fiscani's and headed toward the river. The feel of the wind off the water always stirred an unnamed excitement within him, and he found his footsteps quickening as he neared his favorite spot. Cresting the familiar rise overlooking the docks, he saw a beehive of activity surrounding a mid-sized boat, newly arrived from the looks of things. This would set me up for life. Not this exact boat, but another. The merchant smuggler boat from Five Fingers that bribed its way past wartime checkpoints to slide into the city every quarter. The one that was stuffed to the rails with luxuries, coffee, sugar, and exotic spices from the far-off continent of Zoo, as well as cigars out of Tarna, furs and scented oils from Uldenfrost, and the finest Ortic beef that could be had. The one that brought trade for the city of Meriwen its people never saw. Not the poor, anyway. The one that had been whored out to the Cadoran occupiers by wealthy merchants who ignored and betrayed their own countrymen for the chance to fatten their purses. That was the one. The gold boat, as it was known, had been making runs from Five Fingers along the Dragon's Tongue River and then up the Black River since long before the Northerners had invaded. The rotten Lely's merchants hadn't missed the opportunity to slip cream into the sauce, using little luxuries to get in good with the mongrels running the nation at the time. When the Cadorans emerged from the forest and laid claim to Lael, the tack of the merchants changed only in who they provided their favors to. The Cadoran officers welcomed the arrangement, which gave them better access to niceties than they'd had in the motherland, particularly for those from Cador's interior. Every thief in the city dreamed of getting part of those shipments, and Gaston was no exception. For the most part, they kept to daydreaming and stayed well clear of the boat because of its heavy security. Teams of Meriwen's city guard, Cadoran soldiers, and mercenaries guarded every stage of delivery and processing. Attempting to breach that security was tantamount to suicide, and the guard wasn't shy about gruesomely advertising the failures of those few who tried. There were plenty of heads on spikes at the Queen's Gate that could testify to that. Gaston watched the activity on the river with narrowed eyes. Set for life. Ignoring the drizzle, Gaston made his way to the outskirts of Meriwen using side streets and keeping to the less populated areas. This wasn't a day to draw attention, even from innocent Lely's. The last thing he needed were spectators. By the time he reached the Rat's Warren, an isolated and empty area where the few remaining buildings had been heavily scavenged over the years, the huge gun strapped to his back was making his nerves jump and his muscles ache. He'd rigged the back holster after Fitch had seen the gun at his hip. He couldn't take the chance of that happening again, at least until he'd decided what to do with the thing. If the wrong sort of person spotted it and decided to make trouble, Gaston knew he'd get the worst of it. He found the weight of the weapon reassuring, even comforting, in an odd, itchy sort of way. But that wasn't enough to consider keeping it until he knew for sure he could actually use it. It was a far cry from the pathetic holdout pistol he'd owned a couple of years ago, and that thing hadn't lasted more than 6 months. Deciding he'd gone far enough, Gaston chose an abandoned warehouse yard littered with debris and set away from what had once been the main street. He removed his long coat and pulled the quad iron from its holster across his back. He'd examined the gun closely already, but standing there with it in his hands, he felt the thrill that wasn't entirely comfortable. 4 perfect shots in the space of a moment. He should be safe here, far from the eyes of the Cadoran invaders, but he knew this gun would be trouble if he were caught. How far away would a shot be heard? Would it create that explosion of green light? The daylight would help dull the brilliance, and the cover of the rotting buildings would help hide it. But what about the eerie wind? Although he wasn't entirely certain that part hadn't been his imagination. Shaking off his nerves, Gaston opened the breech of the gun and pulled 4 cartridges from his pocket. He'd expected to have to pay to have some made, but the gambler had been carrying several reloads in an outside pocket of the bag. Gaston shook his head.
What the hell kind of trouble would you need a couple dozen rounds like this for?
It wasn't the first time the question had occurred to him, along with a queasy feeling, and he didn't dwell on it. Instead, he kept his hands moving, loading the first set of cartridges into the gun. He looked around for a target and spotted a pile of broken crates about 50 paces away. The paint had faded, but they looked like they'd been red once. Perfect. Gaston faced his target and lifted the gun in his left hand. It didn't feel as awkward and heavy as he'd expected, but he still had the strain to keep the oversized quad barrel from wavering. He figured he'd get used to that over time. He looked down the length of the gun, and the faded red pieces of wood blurred into an ominous, hulking shape in a red coat. He took a breath. As he exhaled, he pulled the trigger. The big gun slammed back against his unbraced wrist and kicked upward hard. A white-hot current of pain shot up his left arm and something smashed into his forehead. The next thing he knew, he was on the wet ground, barely able to breathe. He opened his eyes a fraction and grimaced at the dull light, which drove spikes into his head. When he forced his eyes to stay open and raised his head to look around, stars flickered in front of him. He let his head fall back into the mud as the drizzle petered out. When he'd caught his breath, Gaston sat up slowly, his head complaining. His left arm felt heavy, and he realized he still held the grip of the quad iron tight. His cheeks began to burn as he realized what had happened. He'd brained himself with his own gun. The thing had a hell of a kick. He peered in the direction of the crates and saw to his astonishment that the top crate was demolished, burst into splinters by the force of the bullet. Holy morrow ascended, he thought. His eyes darted to the gun and scanned the metal inlay. Instead of the bright glow he'd seen in the alley, the runes now emitted only a soft light. Relieved, he pulled himself to his feet, groaning, and chose another target. This time he angled his body away from it and planted his feet wide. He set the gun high against his hip and supported the barrel with his right hand to steady it and take some of the weight off his left wrist, which ached intensely from the first shot. Again he took a breath, exhaled, and pulled the trigger. This time he stayed on his feet, but the gun punched back against his gut, and he took a step back even as he doubled over in pain, gasping. God damn this cursed hunk of metal! Through watering eyes, he saw that once again he'd hit his target. He forced himself upright, picked another target, and again took a wide, angled stance. He leaned forward slightly and held the quad iron as before, steadied with his right hand under the barrel, but snugged at the top of his leg. As he took a breath, he could swear his thigh was already aching from the kick. He exhaled. The kick of the weapon shivered through his bones, but Gaston kept his feet and allowed his body to swallow up the vibration. It was a good shot, the best so far, and he decided he'd had enough. He'd proven he still had some skill with a gun, but this thing was too much. Too heavy, too awkward, too conspicuous. All in all, just too dangerous. He'd sell it like he'd planned to do in the first place. However much he wanted to be able to shoot like that, he needed to be able to eat even more.
I'm telling you, Delouche, it's a beautiful weapon,
Gaston said in a low voice.
I took it out to the Rat's Warren yesterday and tried it myself. It handles like a dream.
His stomach growled and he winced. The aromas of the dinner being prepared for the money grubbers who frequented the inn's dining hall made it hard to focus, but he couldn't let a little hunger distract him. Sweet morrow, but that stew smelled amazing. The small, thin man wrinkled his nose, making himself appear even more rodent-like than usual.
Why are you looking to move it, then, hm? I know the kind of quality guns you boys run into. Not worth coin or carrot.
This is different.
Gaston took on what he hoped was an earnest expression and willed himself not to turn his head as the cook took the lid off a pot and stirred.
"Look, I'm trying to help you out with Elena being sick and all. A fine weapon like this should bring a nice profit. You're one of the few men I know who could find a buyer for something this special. And what do I need a huge gun for? If I carried anything, it'd be something elegant.